Stuart Lane, author of Black Broadway, The African-American Contribution to the American Theater. And I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon here on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Shalom uvracha. This is Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am excited, as always, to talk to someone in the show biz, a theatrical person, a person who has acted, who has written plays, and most of all, he has also produced bunches of plays. As a matter of fact, this man has 6 Tony Awards related to productions that he's produced, as well as an Olivier Award that's over in England somewhere. Plus, he is a co-owner of Broadway's Palace Theater with the Nederlanders there. He is a co-restaurant owner, and he is also an author of books. He's written a book about Black Broadway, Black people who have done Broadway theater for years and years. And he's even done a book about Jews on Broadway, which is the most exciting for me, of course. But he is with us on the telephone. His name is Stuart F. Lane, and we welcome him, shalom, to the neighborhood. Shalom, Stuart.
Shalom, ma shalom cha to you.
Oh, ma shalom cha tov toda. Let me ask you, what is your Hebrew name?
Shmoily.
Shmoily?
Yes, that's it.
Shmoily. Were you named, who was the S for?
It was for my Uncle Simon.
Uncle Simon, or Shimon, as I guess he would have been.
Shimon, yeah.
So how much Hebrew do you know?
Just a bissel, and that's Yiddish.
Right. So you were sent to Hebrew school, you were bar mitzvah, of course.
Great Neck, New York. I'm still very close with Rabbi Whittem at Temple Emmanuel.
Temple, wait a minute, were you bar mitzvah at Langard's of Great Neck?
No, we got you at the Glen Oaks Country Club, the old one.
The old Glen Oaks Country, oh my God. So, let me ask, how did you get into theater? What made you love live performances when you were young?
Well, you know, I kind of broke my parents' heart at an early age kind of thing. It's one of those stories where I was third, fourth, and fifth grade when we moved to Great Neck. I was very good friends with this kid, Ricky. And Ricky's father was always home in the afternoon when we'd play with each other. And he'd say, I'd say, Ricky, doesn't your father work for a living? And he'd say, yeah, my dad's an actor. He works at night.
Oh.
Great concept. Everyone else knocks their head against the wall during the day. And he works at night. Tell me more. Well, I'd never heard of his father. And so I didn't think much about it. Ricky and I used to listen to like Broadway shows. We used to watch Twilight Zone episodes together. And then one day he says, my dad's in a Broadway show.
Uh-huh.
And really, I'd never seen a Broadway show before. So, you know, the whole excitement of putting on a tie and jacket and driving into Manhattan and going to a real theater, not one of those matchbox movie houses, but a real Broadway house, and getting a ticket that doesn't say admit one, but says the name of the show right on it, and you get a playbill. And we march down to the front row, and the curtain goes up on a musical called Little Me.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Which was written by Cy Coleman and Dorothy Field, starring Ricky's father, Sid Caesar.
Oh! Oh! Wow.
Lived in Great Neck.
I did. Well, there you go. There's your punchline. Oh, my goodness. Sid Caesar, so what was he like at home? What was Sid Caesar like at home? Any memories? Any anecdotes?
Well, they had a beautiful house, and he had one of the few color TV sets in the neighborhood, even back then. I didn't realize until much later that he had problems with the drugs and the alcohol. But he was fine. He had, three lovely kids. Ricky had an older sister and a younger sister. And the mother was lovely. I mean, they were good. Once in a while, a celebrity would stop by. Actually, we had Lucille Ball there once.
Good Lord. Good. What did you... I mean, you were a kid, so I guess it's not like a grown-up saying, oh, my God, Lucille Ball's in the house. But was it still exciting for you?
This is like 1961. I was like, 10 years old or so.
Wow. But already it was glamorous for you to see someone like Lucille Ball.
Well, the whole idea of seeing this wonderful comedy, Little Me, and then going backstage afterwards and seeing Sid holding court with his friends and backslapping and joking and comparing cigars, and here he has a cot and a TV and a hot plate and a little home away from home. I said, this is great.
So, we're taking you from you're 10 years old and seeing all this. How did you then work your way into really doing it in high school and then beyond?
Well, that was it. I was a Great Neck North. You know, I went to all the drama classes and speech classes and part of the theater club after school. I went to Boston University, got a BFA in acting. Came to New York. I worked with Van Johnson doing Summer Stock and Ed Herlihy, the voice of Kraft, doing Dinner Theater. And I did modeling, and I joined SAG, the three unions, Screen Actors Guild, AFTRA, and Equity. So, you know, I went through all did Summer Stock in North Carolina.
Do you have any great memories or funny anecdotes of when you were doing theater with people like Van Johnson or just traipsing across the Straw Hat Circuit?
Well, yeah, exactly. It was the old, what was left of the Straw Hat Circuit. That particular tour took us from Algonquin, Maine, to the Cape Cod Playhouse, to the Pocono Playhouse. And then later on in the winter, I went down to the Royal Poinciana in Palm Beach to do it. But, you know, Van, you know, he was a star who's like, I guess, you know, we were hoping the young people's stars were rising and his was coming down. But the audience showed up for him. He always wore his red socks. That was his signature. No matter what role he was playing, he had his red socks on. And a very generous man.
Oh, that's nice to know. Any other famous people that you acted with?
I did a movie with Sean Connery once, but that was only an extra.
Whoa. What movie was that?
That was... I think it was called The Next Man. He played like an ambassador to the UN. It was a great day of shooting because they were doing explosions. And, you know, you spend years of training to act and classes and scene study. But when you're actually out there making a movie, they're really blowing things up. It doesn't take a lot of acting to run and panic when things are falling all around you.
It's true. So here's the deal, though. You're working as an actor, but not really in New York. How did you then morph from the acting to more of the backstage world?
Well, you know, by the late 70s, I love New York and I love the theater. And I spent a year in California where they actually really hate theater out there. It's just the lowest form of entertainment you can possibly think of from their point of view.
Lower than radio, my God, yeah.
Yes, and so I came back to New York and started working as an assistant house manager at the Brooks Atkinson Theater when Same Time Next Year was in like fourth year there. And I started learning more nuts and bolts of running a Broadway theater than you know, the idea of being an actor and looking for motivation and character and the meaning of the show. So that's what sort of started the transition. It was the late 70s. I mean, Broadway was in the very dire straits. But you know, it's one of those circumstances where that's when you should get involved. When nobody wants to go there, that's when you buy that stock. When nobody wants to go there, that's when you buy a theater. And that's offered me an opportunity to actually go partners with the Palace Theater here in New York.
No, wait. That still feels like kind of a leap. I mean, to go, you know, just working backstage, learning nuts and bolts, to actually owning a theater and starting to produce, I mean, that's not an overnight kind of a thing.
Well, after a year of doing the house managers, I did Same Time Next Year, I did Tribute, and then I moved over to the Alden Theater where Annie was, and that was about 2 years. I said to Jimmy, you know, Jimmy, house managing has its own challenges, but I really want to produce shows with you. And Jimmy said, you know, I'd love to have you on board. Just, you know, here are my scripts. Pick one, and you'll sit in, you know, invest in it, and invest in one of these shows, and I'll let you sit in on all the meetings, and you'll see how the process works. So I took what was left of my bar mitzvah money, and I decided to invest in a show called Whose Life Is It Anyway, where I was billed as assistant to the producer, Jimmy Niederlander. And that sort of started my career and my education on being a hands-on producer.
So what did you have to, like, for Whose Life Is It, I keep wanting to say Whose Line Is It Anyway, but of course, Whose Life Is It Anyway is the Tom Conti one where he's paralyzed and all that. But let me ask, what did you physically have to do? What went on in the meetings? What did you learn by being an assistant producer on that show?
Well, I learned about casting. I learned about marketing. And I used to watch the director at the time. So you know, each aspect gives you something to the press, the balance of how to get a good cast together. And then, of course, making of the commercial.
And I assume that show was a hit. It probably ran for a while. Mary Tyler Moore went into it for a bit.
Tom Conti won Best Actor. He won a Tony. We lost Best Play that year to The Elephant Man, darn it.
Oh, go figure. Do you have money in the current Elephant Man?
Yeah, Elephant Man. It was the same year, yeah.
No, but do you have money in the current Elephant Man?
Oh, no, they didn't invite me on that one.
Ah, you wish. Oh, well. But you're doing, by the way, we should mention, this man has a show on Broadway. It's called A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, which, by the way, won a couple of Tonys for itself, including Best Musical. So you're doing all right. which is, you know, Mazel Tov, Mazel Tov.
Yeah, the show's great fun, and I'm very proud of it. These guys worked on it for like 11 years, developing this project, and they did a fantastic job with it.
And the interesting thing about that show is it was running, it went through previews, went through week after week, and it was not financially at the box office, it was not really selling. It was a very slow build. And now, of course, it grosses $800,000-$900,000 a week, and it won the Tony and all that. But how did you buffer it to keep it going so that it didn't have to close in the lean times?
Well, the word of mouth was excellent. The reviews were terrific. But you're right, we couldn't quite catch fire. Fortunately, we produced it at a low operating cost, so it allowed us to tread water through that winter. And when the nominations started to come out in the spring, then we took off. And now we're in industry. We've got a tour going out soon. We're going to be doing a London production, and we continue to run strongly here in New York.
So let me ask, though, moving backward also to, let's say, the first production that you yourself were lead producer on, what was that?
That would probably go back to Woman of the Year.
Oh, my gosh, with Lauren Bacall.
With Lauren Bacall, and then I did La Cage aux Folles with
the original
Barry Herman.
No, the first La Cage aux Folles.
I produced the original La Cage aux Folles.
Now back then, you know, and this was not that long ago, but
Alan Carr was really the lead producer on that.
He was still lead, but there were like a couple of one or two or maybe three producers, and then a lot of investors, of course. What the hell happened to Broadway, where there's more producers on the title page than there are actors and everybody else? What's gone on in the past 20, 30 years?
Well, one reason is because Broadway's become big business. The movie industry discovered that where their movies might make $100 million, there are Broadway shows that will gross billions of dollars over a period of time, and they're running decades now. You know, Cats, Phantom of the Opera, running 18, 20 years, these shows.
Well, true, so...
Foreign companies that go on as well on top of that.
But, again, why does it now take a dozen people, not even investors, probably hundreds of investors, but like a dozen names over the title just to get a show up?
Well, you know, today the average, let's say, musical would cost you $15 million to produce, and that kind of money doesn't grow on trees.
So everybody has to be a consortium. So let me ask you, though. Let's say... You have to work with a lot of the same people over and over again. Like, you ask them to be on your show, they ask them to be in theirs. Is there a point where a show comes down the pike, you're not that interested, but you put money in it because you're going to want to work with that producer later on something else?
Definitely. But generally, it's usually a show that you have to, you've got to have some belief it's going to work. I mean, I've worked with a couple producers. Like, I like working with Jeffrey Richards, a terrific producer.
Sure.
We did The Merchant of Venice with Al Pacino together. And certainly when something crosses his desk that he thinks I might be interested in, I like him to be able to call me and, let me look at it.
So what makes a good producer? By the way, we're talking with Stuart F. Lang. He is a producer. He's also an author of books that we will talk about very shortly. But what makes a good producer?
Well, you know, you've got to be able to be creative. You've got to be able to be resourceful. You got to be tenacious. You got to stick with the project. Find something that you like. You know, it's not unusual for it to take 7 years to go from concept to the Broadway stage. So whatever project you work on, you've got to really be committed to it.
And I assume you have to work on 5, 6, 7, 8 projects at a time, just because you never know what's going to get hot?
Exactly.
So what so far would you consider your greatest success as a producer?
My 5 children.
Mazel.
Okay, no. They're all, you know, every baby's wonderful. So, you know, Will Rogers Follies, La Cage aux Folles, Thoroughly Modern Millie, they're all, you know, terrific shows. I love them all, so.
Well, was there one that you can point to as a proudest achievement that was difficult to get off the ground and then succeeded?
Well, I guess both, each show had their own challenges. You know, La Cage aux Folles was a show that I really believed in. I'd worked with Jerry Herman on the Grand Tour, which had flopped, but I got to work with him on this particular show, and it was developing to be more than just a musical. It was becoming a social statement, a political statement, as well as a really funny musical. So you had all these things going for it, which made it just took it out of the realm of just being a Broadway show. Then I worked on Will Rogers Follies, and I got to work with Tommy Toon, and he's an amazing, talented man who took this script and really gave it a Ziegfeld Follies spin to it that no one else could have done. And this guy worked in New York. We we didn't go out of town for tryouts on this one. We had to do it in New York because of time limitations and the cost of mounting the show and moving it. So we actually started previews in New York for 3 weeks, and by God, when you're under that kind of scrutiny, it's so distracting. But Tommy's nose to the grindstone, you know, he took advice, he listened, he worked at it, and at the end of that three-week period in New York, he delivered a Tony Award-winning musical, multiple Tony Award-winning musicals.
That's right, the Will Rogers Follies. So,
And then I worked on Thoroughly Modern Millie. You know, again, very talented. Michael Mayer was our director. Talented Dick Scanlon did the book and music with Janine Sassori. But when we came to New York, we were running 3 hours. I'm like, this is not Les Miserables. This is not an epic story. This is a show that should be told in 2.5. And we were hacking away at it every night after the show. We're working till 2 a.m, trying to shorten that show.
Wow.
They're all memorable. They're all work.
Let's say you're not stuck, but you're doing Thoroughly Modern Millie. It's running 3 hours. Who's making the cuts? Are you saying to just the book writer, please, you know, do this, or are you just saying, we need to cut 15 minutes, you do what you have to do? How involved are you in the aesthetic process of it?
Well, in that case, I was pretty close. I was working with one of the producers that had taken over, Hal. It was a combination of teamwork in that we wanted to cut some of the dance numbers down. So Rob Ashford was our choreographer, and we sort of cut some, redid some numbers and cut them down. We cut some songs down, we cut some scenes down, and just kept chipping away at it because, you know, you don't want to lose the sense of the story and the arc of how the drama is being unfolded.
Right.
So you've got to be very careful where you slice and dice.
Now, moving to the other side of it, you must have had disappointments and shows that you thought, oh, this is really going to click, and it just never happened, and it ran a couple of weeks and died. Well, what is like the most disappointing show that you've had to deal with?
Well, you know, I there's a restaurant in the Broadway district called Joe Allen's.
Sure.
And Joe Allen's has this brick wall, and on that wall are some of the most famous Broadway flops you ever saw.
Okay.
And there's some big names on that wall. Hal Prince is on that wall. David Merrick is on that wall. And yes, Stuart Lane on that wall.
On that wall with?
Yeah, on that wall. It was a show called Frankenstein, and it was the most expensive non-musical Broadway show to close in one night.
Now,
it cost $2 million back in 1980.
Now that's $20 million today, in today's money, I guess. So, there's a show you must have believed in it. Did you look back in retrospect and try and piece together why? Or do you still think, you know, if the critics had just looked at it a little differently, that could have been a hit?
Well, there was a valuable lesson to be learned in that experience, and that was, Brad Farron, who had just done the special effects for a movie called Altered States, was the hottest guy, and we had all the special effects, even from the original Frankenstein movie with Jacob's ladders and, the electricity, and we had surround sound rumbling to make the audience shake, and at the end of the show, the entire Palace Theater collapsed on itself as the castle came down, but the critics just didn't go for it. And I'm having a meeting with Jimmy Niederlander and the ad agency the next morning, and one of our producers was saying, no, let's fight the critics. Let's go find our audience. Let's, how much is it going to cost to find the audience? Well, for another $500,000, we can start a whole ad campaign, but then you need another $500,000 to cover your losses while you wait for the ad campaign to kick in. And Jimmy looks at him and says, you know, save your money for the next show. Let's just cut bait. Sometimes you got to do that. Sometimes you got to do that.
And people, what I wanted to talk with you about is what's happening for the past season or two with Broadway musicals. You're kind of the exception to the rule with Gentleman's Guide, and Kinky Boots is another exception. You've had apparently good musicals, pretty well reviewed, that should be popular with audiences, and yet one after another, they're dying on the vine after just a couple of months, and they lose most of their initial investment. What has been going wrong?
Well, as we know, the Broadway industry, which is thriving, by the way, and this is, I'm going to say from a business point of view, an industry point of view, we are probably in a golden age where the attendance is up like 14% and sales are up about 13%. So two very major factors. So things are going very well as an industry. the odds about having a successful show are still about the same, 5-1 against, you know. So that hasn't changed.
Fair enough. But how do you, if you have a show written by Sting, if you have another show based on Rocky with a giant ring, if you have another show that says that should bring in all the women, like Bridges of Madison County, and yet, and then they get all across the board, not perfect reviews, but a lot of good reviews, what happens? What's the matter?
Well, you know, you can't, just like wildcatting for oil. You can bring in a geologist, an expert. You can bring in a driller who's an expert, and they can say, that's the place to go drill your well. And you drill that well, and it's dry. Okay, go on to the next one. That kind of thing. You can bring in all the experts you want, but you don't know what's really underground. You don't know what's going to be hit. You don't know how the public is going to go after a product. The best thing that I always do is just do the best you can and tell the best story you can.
That makes sense, but like, let's say, if I don't know if you're an investor in this, but let's say you were to give advice to the folks who are producing the musical that's opening next week, Honeymoon in Vegas, or that just opened, excuse me, Honeymoon in Vegas, right? And it's got wonderful reviews out of town. It's got Tony Danza, very popular from TV. The New York Times loved it out of town. They got Brantley's review on it. They bring it to New York, and it can't sell a ticket so far. Having done Gentleman's Guide, which was sort of in the same boat, what do you tell them to do?
Well, unfortunately, at this stage of the game, because they're opening tomorrow night.
Right.
That's on January 15th. I think that the only advice is you're really at the mercy of the critics. You can hope, keep your fingers crossed, that the same critic from the New York Times that raved about it at the David Mill Playhouse will still rave about it, and that could be enough to put you over the top to let the public know how good the show is.
So that's basically, they're if the reviews aren't incredibly stellar, they're going to be in big trouble. As a matter of fact, by the time this interview airs, it may, hopefully not, but it may be even closed. So, or...
Yeah, I mean, apparently the title's not enough to sell tickets, and Tony Danza's name doesn't seem to be large enough to sell tickets, so they're going to be solely relying on good reviews.
But has it gotten to the point now, though, where you really need... Because we've had a lot of plays making a lot of money. The straight plays, and gay plays too, they're making a lot of money, but they got real famous people in them. Is that the new secret, or is that just, you know, happens to be?
Hollywood on the Hudson, that's the new Broadway. There's been an amazing transition in the industry over the last decade or so as more movie studios and television studios have set up shop here in New York, coming back to where it all started. The whole movie industry, you know, used to come out of New Jersey and New York. They're coming home to roost now. And instead of being bi-coastal, where you have to do one or the other, you can do Broadway, you can do off-Broadway, you can do a TV series, all in New York now. So I think it's an amazing time.
And also, don't forget, a movie star can sign on for 3, 4, 5 months, and they can make their money back. He doesn't have to sign a year-long contract to be in a show, and that makes it more...
Now. So, last year I did Orlando Bloom doing Romeo and Juliet for a limited run, and it worked out pretty well. James Franco just did Mice and Men. So this limited run with a star it seems to be a popular way of doing things. And in fact, I'm trying to capitalize on that. I have a new company called Broadway HD where I'm actually digitally capturing Broadway shows, and then I'm going to show it in movie theaters and other platforms that are now available because of technology.
How did you get Equity to agree to that? People have been wanting to preserve Broadway shows for years, and all you can do is see them at the Lincoln Center Library. How did you finally make the deal to do this?
Well, you know, it's been a long process. I'm going to say, you know, can go back 20 years to when the Japan Satellite Broadcasting Company first decided to shoot Will Rogers' Follies, and the union said, okay, but you can only show it in Japan on a pay-per-view basis.
Right.
And so that was 20 years ago. Now, then you evolve into shows where they were able to do, like they shot the last performance of Sophisticated Ladies, or they shot the last performance of Smokey Joe's Cafe. As technology started to get better, the union started to come up with more templates on how to do contracts. Now, the DVD market is really on the way out, and people are just like looking to the internet for streaming, like in Netflix.
Right.
And I think that by doing this sort of Broadway HD, we're able to actually generate additional newfound revenue for the shows that otherwise would just, you know, closed and gone home.
And I think maybe the fears of Broadway producers and the unions were allayed by things like a movie being made of Jersey Boys and the movie of Mamma Mia and Chicago, having successful movies that millions of people see, but it doesn't stop the Broadway shows. It doesn't have a chilling effect on ticket sales. If anything, it helps them.
You're right, Rabbi, you're absolutely right, because there was always concern. But, you know, you take a show like Annie, that had a good, healthy run. In fact, it ran so long for its day. It was like over 7 years. During that period, the option to make a movie came up. They actually made the movie and released it while the show was running, and it did not affect ticket sales at all for the Broadway show. Sometimes it's even been proven to help out, like Chicago.
The movie, exactly, yeah.
And the Broadway show is still running.
So, I mean, that's a huge thing. I think that was a big hurdle that people had to get over in the Broadway business to say, it's all right, we can put it on movie screens, we can put it on TV, it's all right, then the show will still be there.
It so, works more as a marketing tool and helps you leverage the show that way.
And so have you chosen, like, the first one or two shows that you're thinking of HD-ing across the globe?
Well, I've got Orlando Bloom's Romeo and Juliet in the can. And I've just teamed up with HBO to shoot Audrey McDonald in Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill.
Oh, that's
quite. It's not quite the Broadway digital. We're actually shooting it in a nightclub in New Orleans. But it's the same script. It's the same actress and the same script and the same director.
But with the Orlando Bloom Romeo and Juliet, that was actually shot when the show was still on Broadway?
Yes, we shot it in the Broadway theater. Two performances, 9 cameras. It was very exciting.
Are you ever going to do the live kind of thing?
Live gets a little bit trickier because we're stuck with 3 different time zones here in the States.
Oh.
And so it's more of an encore. You know, we capture it and then you can watch it at your leisure.
Okay, that's cool. That's good. Because I remember a couple of months ago when Monty Python were doing their farewell thing. They did that, like that last performance. They put in movie theaters all over the place. And that was quite popular.
Movie theaters are now looking for alternate content. The movie industry is having a tough time, and Broadway's thriving. You know, you can't pirate a live Broadway show. So we're not trying to compete with Broadway. That's why our motto is, if you can't see it on Broadway, see it on Broadway HD. We're the alternative.
How much investing or producing or anything do you do for off-Broadway?
You know, I do some. I've worked with Manhattan Theater Club and the AMCC. I've done some to help develop some projects.
But it tends not to be where your focus is because...
Oh, well, yeah, because that's not where the
money is. You have 5 children to put through college. Let me ask you...
Exactly.
Do any of them want to be in the business? Are you encouraging, discouraging, if they want to be actors or performers or writers, directors?
The short answer is no. I never try to discourage it, but it's one of those professions that you really have to have the fire in your belly to pursue it and be, you know, stick with it. My 2 older daughters are not as interested as my soon-to-be, my 17-year-old, who's a junior in high school, and she seems to be interested in directing and playwriting and exploring singing and, I mean, all the aspects of it. She's done some opera, she's done some dance, so she's really, you know, trying out all the performing arts to see which she prefers.
Okay, hey, yeah, at her age, allow her. Let her do it. Give her until 29 and a half. And then you tell her what to do. But for the next 10 years, let her explore. Let her enjoy. Yeah, and we are, by the way, enjoying our conversation with Stuart F. Lane. He is the producer. He's also a playwright. And he is the author of a couple of books, including Choose of Broadway, which I am partial to. But his latest book is called Black Broadway, African Americans on the Great White Way. So what was the impetus for now becoming a theater historian alongside all the other things you do?
Well, you know, with Jews on Broadway, having been born like mid-20th century, I was living some of it, so it makes it a little easier.
Yeah.
And having known Sid Caesar, I kind of had a little branch to the past from several decades. So that kind of started the idea that I could do it. And then when I started going into the whole history of Broadway and America itself, the idea of the African-American contribution is so original and so rich. It helped me expand it. And I had to get a new publisher for it as well. And the publisher shared my enthusiasm for expanding on illustrations and pictures. So we have beautiful pictures from Playbill and posters and from papers and from publicity shots. It was very rare, so it was a very exciting book. It's a nice size coffee table book.
people should know it's not only text. I've looked through the book online that they were kind enough to send me a link, and the photos are gorgeous, and it should be used as a textbook, because there's all sorts of sidebars, and there's biographical stuff, and when you go into a new decade, you list all these famous actors who are like, and these are the cast of characters we're going to write about now. And it's a lovely... I could see this being used as a text in theater classes, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, and with the publisher's help, we have a timeline on the bottom, so while you're reading about the actors and the shows they were doing, you get a timeline of what was going on in America at the same time for the black community.
So how, I'm curious, first of all, how long did it take you to write this book?
It's about a year and a half to write it, it's about another year and a half to get the photos and the rights to them.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it doesn't happen overnight.
So when you were writing it, did you conceive the visual look of the book? Because it's not just... turn the page, oh, there's an illustration, a few more pages of text and illustration. I mean, it's really blocked out like a textbook. I mean, did you have to write with that mindset, or did that come later?
That came later. That came later when the publisher and I sat down and said, let's highlight certain areas, let's expand on sort of the actors.
Wow.
That was with the Square One Publishing.
So what are some surprising things that you learned about black theater in writing this book about black Broadway? Things you didn't know, things you really wanted to put forward?
Well, I think one of the first items is in the early days, how important it was. Communications were so limited that people got their education from, I guess, either the newspapers or theater. And when, I think one of the big watershed moments was when they did a stage version of Uncle Tom's Cabin, which brought the whole concept of slavery in the most realistic fashion at the time, to people in New England, to people, you know, who had never been south of the Mason-Dixon line, kind of thing. I think the other fascinating point was the 1920s was a kind of a singularity point where so many things converged. It was an amazing decade in the history of American culture and economics. Not only was the roaring 20s and Prohibition going on, but this whole migration that came, the black community came north, because of the Jim Crow laws that were scaring them off. They sort of came up to New York and created the whole golden age of Harlem, the whole Harlem Renaissance. So you get Duke Ellington, you get jazz, you start inventing the American forms. What are the three forms of art that the performing arts of America has contributed to? Musical theater, the jazz, and the tap dancing.
You know, oh, right. Right. So, and... Are there going to be further editions? Like, I don't know if you've updated the Jews of Broadway book, but like, is there a thing where every 10 years you kind of have to, you know, do another decade?
Well, you know, the answer is why not? We'll see what the publisher says on that. But I was able to bring this one pretty much up to date, because I, you know, even to like just getting it published, I was able to include The Trip to Bountiful as one of the last shows, and some of the contemporary producers there, like Stephen Bird. So it does cover a wide range, and it could use an update. And if I get a chance, The Jews on Broadway, I'd love to add some photographs to that.
Yeah. I mean, if you can make it look like the Black Book, that would be lovely. And you have another book about how to produce. I'm forgetting the title of it, but was it Let's Put on a Show?
Yeah, so Let's Put on a Show. It's how to produce for the theater. Tremendous success with that book. They just published it in Chinese this summer.
In Chinese, Micah. So what are one or two pieces of advice that you haven't given us already that you have in the Let's Put on a Show book for a budding producer?
Oh, well, a producer, the ability to find a project, develop it, to collaborate, to raise money. It's a terrific industry to be in because you get to work with some amazingly talented people. And these are extraordinary people, whether it's an Audrey McDonald or it's John Lithgow. I mean, they've got talent, and the talent goes beyond just adding up numbers or, I've worked with Alan Menken, the composer of Little Mermaid. You know, nice guy, but a talent that's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also happens to be a very nice fellow, so.
Yeah, he was a guest on this program last year, we're very proud to say.
Yeah.
Very, very nice.
Then you know, yeah.
A very nice Jewish man, by the way. So
nice Jewish man.
So, but let me ask you, has it, in since a show now costs $15 million, it's kind of different from the old days of you go to your dentist, and if he has $20,000 to put in a show, you kind of schmooze him, he schmoozes. Does that still happen, or is it really different?
It hasn't happened for me, let me put it that way.
Hasn't happened for me either. I'm still looking for people to invest in my show, so how do you get money out of people?
Oh, well, you know, I show them what I have and try to get them excited about it. And if it clicks, then it's good, because I make them part of the whole process. They get to sit in on the meetings that I have with the advertising agency, the press agent, even the rehearsals. I try not to inundate the director or the artistic team with too many questions, so I usually funnel it through me.
Okay.
But I make sure all my investors are heard.
So, but how do you find the people with the pockets? Is it just the more you do, the more people you're introduced to?
Yeah, pretty much. Cocktail parties, on a casual basis. I've rarely had to go go out and beat the bushes, but I invite people to, readings or presentations.
Cool. And obviously it's been...
I'm doing a new musical now called The Moment in Time.
Is that the John Denver one?
Yeah, it's a new one. I'm going to be doing a presentation for the industry in early March. I got the rights to the John Denver songbook, and it inspired me to create a new, totally original book using his music and lyrics of John Denver.
Interesting. But his famous hit songs put into that book. Not quite like a jukebox musical, but in some ways like that, yes?
Well, it's not a bio musical. It's just a totally original story with his music.
Wow. So the first part of the process is the book is written. You've got it. Now you're going to do an industry reading for people.
Mind you, I've only been working on it 4 years now.
Oh, only 4 years. Well, yeah.
Only 4 years. So I've already done one small production, did a couple of readings. I've done rewrites. I did a lab last October in California. So now we're ready to do what I call an industry reading to show the public, the business, the industry people, what I have. So we've got the choreography. We'll have the music. We'll have the actors. No sets, costumes, or lighting for it. Just the bare bones, and then try and book a tour and then get a theater based on that.
And what other things, what other irons do you have in the fire? What else are you investing or producing or thinking about producing?
Well, I've been involved with this new Gloria Estefan musical called On Your Feet that'll be coming out next fall.
Well, that's due on Broadway.
Miami Sound Machine.
Yeah, that's set for Broadway, isn't it?
What's that?
That one is already set for Broadway. I think it has a theater, right?
Yeah, it's going to be playing the Marquee in fall of 2015, yeah.
Wow, okay. So where is that? How is that developing?
I just saw the workshop, and I thought it was amazingly done. Beautiful, terrific actors. The male and female leads are so compelling and nice, and the music is the Miami Sound Machine, so it's very exciting to see them on the stage. So I'm very looking forward to that. And then, of course, at the Palace Theater, we're going to have a stage version of An American in Paris starting in March.
Oh, my God.
Opening April 12th.
So your day, like you're very kind to take some time out to talk with us here in the neighborhood today. What is an average day for you? If you're writing books, if you have the gorgeous wife, you got the 5 kids, and you're a playwright, and you're trying to produce. I mean, is it you're on the phone half the day? What is a day for you like?
No 2 days are alike, I'll tell you that.
Okay.
Some days are quiet, some days things happen. It's hard to, can't predict these things.
I mean, putting out fires? I mean, like what's on your docket for the rest of this afternoon?
Well, I've got a 1 o'clock conference call where I'm discussing my contract with some of my people in the show I'm working on. I've got, I'm meeting with a couple of other people in the afternoon, but then I have to pick up my kids from school at 4 o'clock, so...
Wow, that's just amazing. And then at night, are you going to a show?
Well, one of the advantages of living in Manhattan is, yes, I get to... My lifestyle's curtailed because I stay home to have dinner with the kids every night, but I get to see the show. So, at 7:15, I'm out of the house to catch an 8 o'clock curtain.
Right, exactly. Plus, you have to fly, I assume, all over the country and back and forth to London sometimes to see if you want to be involved in a property. Is that true?
You know, Rabbi, I'll tell you something amazing. The last 13 years or so, with technology the way it is, it's made life so much easier. I'm able to produce Top Hat in London and just Skype on the computer with the marketing people once a week, and that's all I need.
Wow. Wow.
So I don't have to go to London all the time to see them, once in a while, but not every month or every week do I have to be out there. And the same thing with the scripts. I can read scripts, I can see set designs, I can see costume designs. And unless I'm actually casting something or I'm directing something where I have to be there physically, It's an amazing world we have. I have a summer home in the Hamptons. I'm able to stay out there, you know, 8 weeks out of the summer.
And you're still working from there, because everything is telephone and Skype and email and all of that.
It's been an amazing transformation the last, you know, 12 years or so.
Well, it has been an amazing and delightful conversation with producer Stuart F. Lane. Remember that his book, his new book, Black Broadway, African Americans on the Great White Way, is available from Square One Publishers. You can find out more about that book and everything that Mr. Lane does by going to his website. This is the best URL for a website ever, MrBroadway.com. How'd you think of that URL? That's perfect. MrBroadway.com. And you really are. Are you writing any plays?
I haven't been able to sit down and rewrite a play, but I've got a couple of ideas I'm working on.
When you write a play, how do you figure, do you want to self-produce, do you send it, like everybody else, to agents, or what do you, in your position, do with a play of your own?
Well, you know, once it's first completed, I give it to my wife to look at.
Okay. Yeah. I mean,
look at it till it's finished either. She says, I don't want to see it by half a play. I want to see a full play or nothing.
Fair enough, but let's say she likes it.
Well, yeah, then we'd start, you know, see what we want to do with it, bring in a director, bring in other people to come in and produce it with us, you know. Then the process starts.
The process starts. Well, last question for Stuart Lane. One of the lectures that you give, because you're also a public speaker, and you talk about Broadway and theater and producing, you go to schools, and one of your lectures is, what can schools learn from a Broadway producer? Well, what do you tell students? What do you tell the kids?
Well, you know, I'm on the board of overseers at BU, and I do a lot with Emerson College as well. And I try to tell them that the talents that someone has can manifest themselves in many ways. So if you start off as an actor, which is the most accessible, let's say, form to get into the business, leave yourself open to directing and set design and costume design and casting, because the whole industry is filled with people who used to be an actor, but now they're a casting director, or now they're a producer, or a theater owner. So I tell them to leave themselves open for all the myriad of possibilities that are available to them, if they can just discover their talent.
Sounds like wonderful, wonderful advice. And we thank you that you have opened yourself up to tell your truth, your story. Stuart F. Lane, I wish you much, much success with An American in Paris, with the upcoming John Denver musical, with the Feet musical about the Estefans, and everything else that you're working with. Thank you again for being in the neighborhood.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Shalom to you.
Shalom.